Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Some businesses in the La Crosse area have a problem. They can have a hard time attracting the best and brightest workers. While the region is home to several universities and colleges, those graduates often leave the area, taking their talent elsewhere. Local business leaders have been brainstorming ways to keep high-skilled workers in the area and to convince others that the Cooley region is a great place to work. Here today to talk about recruitment and retention are Lisa Hare. She's executive director of Seven Rivers Alliance, and John McHugh. He's manager of corporate communications for Quick Trip. Hare talks about what she's heard from businesses.
Being new to the area, I spent the first couple of months visiting companies and reaching out to board members to find out what their needs were. And I was surprised to learn about the need to attract talent and how strong it is in this region because we export a lot of our human capital.
You hear a lot about the brain drain in Wisconsin or in the La Crosse area.
Right. And I think this area is very reflective of that, given that we have five colleges and universities within a one-hour proximity of each other. And so a lot of talent comes here, but they don't always get to stay here. And some of that is by choice, and some of that is by opportunities that they're looking for.
And John, are you experiencing this at Quick Trip, just a need to attract younger, more high-skilled workers?
Yeah, our need to attract people is actually more proactive than reactive. The last couple of years, we certainly have not had a problem finding good talent here in the La Crosse market. Last year, for example, at Quick Trip company-wide, we had over 117,000 applications. However, we know that that trend is not going to continue. And with the number of baby boomers retiring, there's not enough people to replace them, and especially in those skilled areas. As Lisa mentioned, those people who are trained well here in the La Crosse area, because we have great education, as soon as they get out of school, they have a tendency to go out to the West Coast or the East Coast. It's a great lifestyle environment for them. And so we want to make sure that they know that the Cooley region is still an excellent place to live and work and raise a family.
So Lisa, are there certain fields that different businesses need or have a harder time attracting? Like, I've heard IT can be difficult in this area.
What we're seeing right now is pretty reflective of the country as a whole.
Okay.
IT, even accounting, basic business functions tend to be really in high demand. Healthcare has been in demand. It continues to be in demand as well. So those are the areas that we're trying to address in a more systemic way as far as recruiting. Recruiting for IT is a little bit different.
How
just
so?
Like the personalities of individuals who go into IT, they tend to not prefer working in teams. They like to work more on their own. They also like to work a schedule that fits their lifestyle. Nights, weekends, a lot of coding and programming goes on after midnight. And so it's understanding the lifestyle of the people who go into those different fields.
I've heard before, too, different businesses in the area say, you know, we'd love to bring these bright minds from the IT world to La Crosse, but look at what's going on in Silicon Valley, where people are starting new businesses left and right. You could go work for Google, something like that. You know, how do we bring that talent to La Crosse?
One of the things we've been doing at Quick Trip is to make sure that we're named every year to the top workplaces programs. Because what we find is the younger people who are talented have options. And people who have options, they research the companies. And so places like Google, which is frequently on the list of the Fortune magazine's list of great companies to work for, we're competing against the Googles of the world in the Silicon Valley. So we need to let these people know when they do a search that the companies here in the Cooley region, they also are great places to work and do offer, as Lisa mentioned, workplace flexibility, especially for IT people.
What can Quick Trip do to attract the Googles of the world, besides making sure you get on a list like the Fortune 500 list?
Being on the list is certainly important. Secondly, if we can at least get those people, if they've never been to the Cooley region, to come and see. The younger demographic really appreciates the fact that there's such diversity in terms of beauty, geography, activities, regardless of the season. When they come here and they see that, it's really one of our commodities that we don't utilize enough to promote the area.
I would think that maybe just promoting the outdoor recreational area, because, I mean, when you're talking lists, La Crosse generally shows up on lists when it comes to outdoor rec and things like that.
That's a huge driver for us.
Absolutely. It's one of our greatest assets in the region that we need to maximize and promote more. And so it's working with our employers to figure out how to do that. So pairing them with organizations like the Outdoor Recreation Alliance and others who have that focus and do that very well. There are models around the region where communities are coming together and chambers are involved with recreation and the companies in kind of a triangle in offering that service to showcase, even do tours to show all the capabilities as far as canoeing, skiing. We have it all here, and that's the kind of lifestyle work-life balance they're looking for.
And it's not just geography. It's also just the attraction to the Midwest culture that we have here in the Cooley region. People are friendly here. It's a good environment to raise a family. Lisa's a good example. When we tried to recruit Lisa for this job, we had to make sure that she knew this was a great place to live and to work.
Yes, absolutely.
And so then what sold you, Lisa, if you want to talk a bit about that in deciding to come to the Cooley region?
I think for me, it was definitely looking at the quality of life for my family. And because I come from the Pacific Northwest, I love the outdoors. And I love all the seasons and the sports that go with it. And knowing that that was here and all within an easy driving distance was incredibly appealing.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about recruiting and retaining high-skilled workers to the La Crosse area. My guests are Lisa Hare. She's executive director of Seven Rivers Alliance. And John McHugh. He's the manager of corporate communications for Quick Trip. So we talked a bit about recruiting people to the area. What about retaining? Is that a whole other beast? Convincing people that you should stay in La Crosse?
I think especially with the younger workforce that is going to be the dominant workforce in the next 10 years, we have to ensure that our corporate culture is a place that they want to stay in. The younger workers typically are committed to an employer for about 2 years.
Sure.
And then they flit onto the next opportunity that becomes available. And so corporate culture and meaningful work are going to be critical. They need to know that the work that they're doing contributes to the company as a whole and impacts the community where they live.
And then with corporate culture, I mean, what is it that Quick Trip can do to make sure that you have a culture that is attractive to workers of all skill levels and all generations, too?
Yeah, Lisa hit the nail on the head. One of the big drivers is that sense of purpose. So we do a lot of work with all of our coworkers, 14,000, on our mission statement. It's to treat others as you like to be treated, make a difference in someone's life. Because what we found is they don't simply want a paycheck. They want to know that at the end of the day, something they did at work makes a difference. And good employers are doing a nice job of helping coworkers find that sense of purpose in their work. That's real important to us. Secondly, we also know that a great culture is contingent upon your immediate supervisor. You can have great benefits, you can have great pay, you can have workplace flexibility, but if your immediate supervisor doesn't treat you with compassion and trust, you'll go someplace else. That's certainly the case with the younger generation. The baby boomers had a tendency to really stay in a job for close to a lifetime. Now, if you're in one of the younger generations, you may have, just in your 20s, five different jobs, five different locations.
Do we have any sense as to why that happens more now than ever before?
People have options, and especially if you want to recruit A talent, A players have options. If you're a talented person, you can go someplace else. If it's not the best work environment, you have options.
Lisa, how do you work with different employers in the area to make sure that an employee isn't leaving after 2 or 3 years, that they do stick around? How do you improve the corporate culture?
The best way we can do it is by bringing in best practices for the employers to learn from the region and also around the country. What are those manufacturing companies who have a wait list of people who want to come work? Those are the kinds of companies that we need to profile and connect them with so they understand that this workforce to stay engaged has to not only be treated fairly, but feel like they're valued. And I think John is absolutely correct. We are discovering in our business practices that that needs to be universal across the company, and it can't just be talk. You have to walk it, and you have to embody it from the leadership all the way down.
Studies have shown that really there's two characteristics, pretty simple characteristics, that every employee wants, regardless of what their demographic is. They want compassion, and they want trust in a workplace environment.
And is that easier said than done?
And that certainly is easier said than done. We actually interview for a fit with compassion and trust. We think that you can't always train those areas. That's something that has to be a natural core competency. So in our interview process, we'll ask questions like, tell me about the last random act of kindness you did for someone. Tell me how you made a difference in someone's life. Tell me how you've treated others as you would like to be treated. We're trying to find those people that naturally fit those areas of compassion and trust. And if we find them and they have those skills, then we can put them to work and we know they'll do the right thing. And their people will stay.
Lisa, are other businesses in the area, are they, you know, approaching things this way?
Absolutely. I think Miller Ingenuity in Winona is a great example. Steve Blue has worked very hard to create a warm atmosphere that makes not only employees feel welcome and valued, but that their work is important and they are part of the overall company mission. And I think that connection is vital for keeping that employee engaged and also helping them to develop. Those companies that have some kind of professional development plan and there's opportunities for advancement. And if there isn't opportunities for advancement within the organization, then they work with that employee to find where they will be successful at that next level.
So are companies having difficulties in maybe approaching some of these mindsets differently? And where, when it comes to recruitment and retention, what are some of the biggest barriers that are still in place for companies?
I think for us in our industry, there's certainly a stigma that people say, well, I don't want to go work for a gas station. That's not a preferred place to work. So we have actually in the last 7 years developed an entire recruiting program, a set of recruiters that go out and ship people loose. They go to other places and look for a talent and say, hey, we're a great place to work. Why don't you Google us? You'll find that that's the case. Come work for QuickTrip. So right now, recruiting departments play a pretty critical role in getting people. If you're an A player, A players are currently employed. Most A players are not looking for work. You have to go out and try to find those people.
Lisa?
I think strategies using social media and LinkedIn. LinkedIn is one of the number one recruiting tools right now where recruiters are going out and prospecting people who are employed, and they're doing extensive searching for those individuals who have the skill set that they're looking for. And so helping those employers to understand the power of social media and understand how it can be used as a tool is going to be really important.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about retaining and recruiting high-skilled workers to the La Crosse area. My guests are Lisa Hare. She's executive director of Seven Rivers Alliance, and John McHugh. He's manager of corporate communications for QuickTrip. So you two told me an interesting fact before we started recording here today, that this is the first time that four generations have been simultaneously working out in the workplace, which is fascinating to me.
It's the first time in human history you have four generations working side by side. Obviously, because we're living longer, people have to work longer because maybe their 401ks haven't been as successful as they thought. We actually do training for all of our managers on the differences in communication styles between the four generations, because depending on where you grew up and when you grew up, it affects how you approach work. We think that close to 65% of all tension in the workplace environment is because of differences in generational attitudes at work.
Wow. So how do you work with different companies to try to address some of these concerns, Lisa?
I think the big thing is helping to educate the leadership who is going to be working with younger workers about effective communication strategies, problem solving, even performance reviews. Something as simple as how you provide constructive feedback to an employee can really determine whether they are willing to accept that feedback in a meaningful way or they think of that job as a dead end and they start looking to go elsewhere. And so bringing those best practice strategies to employers to help them really think about how they engage their employees. What is that work relationship? And I think that's the thing that's changed. It used to be you hire an employee, you tell them to do the job, they do the job. And now we have a generation coming up that says, well, I need to know why. I need to know why this is important. I need to know how I contribute to the overall mission. I need to understand what kind of impact this is having on the community and how I am going to better the community in this role. And for older generations, that's a lot of time wasted. That's often what I hear. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating. I don't have time to explain all that to you. I just need you to get the job done. And the younger workers are struggling because they need that information to get the job started. And so that disconnect, we need to show those best practices and elsewhere where they have been able to bridge that.
It's so interesting. John?
That transparency for companies is really a key component. It really requires companies to communicate more than they've ever communicated with their employees, sharing everything from information that they would share usually, traditionally, only at the highest level. We make sure that all of our coworkers even have access to the same packet of information that our board of directors receives. That kind of transparency, I think, would have been unheard of 20, 30 years ago.
Sure. So we're talking about the baby boomer generation, Generation X, the millennials, and then what's that fourth generation?
The matures.
The matures,
yeah.
People
who grew up through the Depression and World War II.
Okay.
Yep.
And like you said, Lisa, the younger generation, maybe the millennials, they want to feel like they're, you know, an important member of society and the work that they do matters, whereas maybe some of the older generations just go to work, get the paycheck, get home.
Exactly. And I think that interesting development is going to change our world of work in the next 10 years, especially as these younger workers become the dominant worker. When our workforce is going to be 75 to 80% millennials in 2025, imagine what kind of workplace that will be. And for me, that's very exciting. I think those managers and supervisors who can embrace that as a new opportunity to grow and learn a new skill set will be the ones who will thrive with the younger workforce coming forward.
It even changes how we train people.
Really?
The younger generation, their attention span is much shorter than the baby boomers. It's a practical reason. Most of us who are Gen Xers or millennials grew up with 30-minute sitcoms. In a 30-minute sitcom, every 7 minutes, there's a commercial. So they've been trained to think in 7-minute intervals. Hmm. So for our training programs, we actually make sure that we don't spend more than 7 minutes on any given one page or one topic. We also use a lot more multimedia than ever before. Their attention span is shorter, and that's not a bad thing, but it just puts a certain emphasis on how the quality of training that you do for your frontline coworkers.
Are there other things that millennials are looking for in a workplace? I mean, we look to, like, Google, which is probably the poster child of benefits for millennial workers, you know, free lunches. But, I mean, that's an exception. So what else are they looking for?
The one thing that I hear over and over is the need for FaceTime and personal engagement. They need to know that their supervisor wants to have a personal relationship with them. And for the traditional supervisor and manager, that could be a little awkward or uncomfortable because sometimes it crosses those lines of professional boundaries. Whereas the younger workers don't have the boundary. It's not there. They see
their
work
connected.
And life all as one complete timeline. And so they expect to engage with their supervisor in all those ways. And so for someone who's not comfortable with Instagram and Twitter, it can be a little bit daunting.
They say that the number one reason why either a Gen Xer or a millennial will quit a job, it's because of their relationship with their immediate supervisor. Whereas my father, who was a baby boomer, would have said, geez, if you don't like your supervisor, suck it up. I mean, you can't go someplace else because they didn't have as many options. You know, that's why they were the baby boomers. There were too many people and not enough jobs. So they didn't have the choice to be selective. Whereas now I manage a whole host of millennials and Gen Xers, and it's not uncommon on any given weekend that they'll be texting me, asking me questions, where my dad, I would never imagine him calling his boss on a Saturday or Sunday and asking him a question about work. You have to be open to that kind of communication.
Are there other companies, not to have you pick favorites, but other companies in the area that you think are really approaching some of these issues in the right way?
I think that a number of the companies who have best practices in being a great place to work, we have a couple of different programs like that, Workplaces That Work. There's all these different mm-hmm. variations of that program are great examples that businesses should look at and Google to understand how in their industry it has been adopted, strategies that have been adopted that work. So it's a little different. Healthcare is a little different mm-hmm. because you have regulations, you have patient confidentiality. There's things that make it a little different. However, even there, that ongoing 24/7 communication probably will be the easiest transition for the industry than it has been in other industries as well.
And interestingly enough, we talk about the Googles of the world in Silicon Valley. When you talk to the top workplaces programs, they do these programs nationally, they'll say that the most competitive market for top workplaces is here in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa, the upper Midwest, is that we have a much higher percentage of companies that really work at retaining and attracting talent than any other place in the country right now.
Are there other companies that QuickTrip looks to when you're developing your own practices?
There are. I know Edward Jones certainly ranks high in terms of employee satisfaction. We certainly looked at a lot of their areas. There's actually several areas out on the East Coast, places, supermarkets that do a really good job of hosting great work environments. So obviously, because we're a retail business, a lot of times we'll concentrate on those retail establishments. There's a grocery store chain that we don't have here in Wisconsin, but it's out on the East Coast called Wegmans. And Wegmans is frequently number one, number two, number five on the top workplaces list. They do a nice job of retaining and attracting talent.
I think John just hit on something that's really important for the businesses who are listening. It's really important for them to identify those aspirational companies that they want to be like. And maybe we're not even talking revenue or specific growth strategy. We're talking about corporate culture. So looking at those businesses that have identified a corporate culture that they want to adopt and inherit. You know, the one that I hear all the time locally, that and I'm new, is Festival Foods, as far as how they've created that culture among their employees. And so what other ones are out there for those grocery chains or any kind of retail food service industry that they're looking at to find those?
We're real fortunate here in the area that we also have a lot of promotion of what's called the servant leadership culture.
Sure.
And because of that, companies like Festival take that as part of their mantra. And that's part of a great culture. Not only that, but that culture is also
Do you want to explain what servant leadership is for those not familiar
sure.
with it?
Servant leadership really is a basic concept that you treat your people as you'd like to be treated. You know, the golden rule applied to business. It's making sure that you talk about those two characteristics we mentioned of compassion and trust. And very simply put, it's that. It's being a leader that really cares about his people or her people. It really is that in a nutshell. We're lucky to have that here. And it also pays dividends. If you looked at the studies, companies that have a good servant-led culture, who make culture important, are 16 times more profitable than the stock market average over time. It's a very famous study that's been done. So people say, well, culture, that's about HR and it's about fluff. Well, really, when you look at it, there's a huge ROI, return on that investment, when you invest in your people.
What's really interesting about all this, and especially as, you know, businesses like QuickTrip or any other business in the area, is as the generations change, as the millennials age and the generation that's coming in behind them, how businesses are really going to have to keep up with this and how this is going to be so fluid over the next few decades.
And it's not just the HR department and it's not just the training division. We have an event coming up we're going to talk about a little bit later, but we encouraged companies to bring their internal champions to the event. So it's not just one or two people. It's understanding that throughout the organization, there has to be ownership for embracing a culture not only of servant leadership and transparency, but authentic leadership, that you actually really care about the well-being of the people who work for you.
And that's where we're real fortunate here in the Cooley region. You look at our major healthcare institutions and you look at the major businesses in our area, the CEOs of these companies and these healthcare institutions, they get it. They are good servant leaders. You look at all the companies and all the areas here in Wisconsin, in the Cooley region. We have it. We're lucky.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about recruiting and retaining high-skilled workers to the La Crosse area. My guests are John McHugh. He's the manager of corporate communications for QuickTrip, and Lisa Hare. She's executive director of Seven Rivers Alliance. So, you know, it's within the best interest of the entire community to attract and keep really high-skilled workers. Is it up to businesses to lead this force, or, you know, are there things that city government, county government can do? Obviously, higher education institutions.
I don't think the workforce challenge we're talking about is exclusive to just business. And I predict that we're going to have the same vacancies in the public sector that we will in the private sector. So everybody's going to have to adjust how they relate and interact with their coworkers in the next 10 years as they become this dominant workforce. And we're already seeing in much of the public sector the same graying, retiring workforce that we do in the business sector. I think the important part is connecting businesses with students sooner, not just waiting until they become available, and then they're hunted. They're hunted by recruiters, and the businesses, as John pointed out, become reactive and not proactive. So how do those organizations develop internships and create talent pipelines earlier on so that they start to create that meaningful relationship with the person so that they look forward to working for Quick Trip when they graduate? And it's not a second thought.
Sure.
A lot of times we think of those skilled areas simply in terms of IT or accounting, but skilled areas is a much broader term for us. We know that there's a shortage of people like diesel mechanics and truck drivers. So we've partnered with WTC here in the Cooley region to make sure that we can get into that pipeline with those students long before they ever graduate. Because if we don't get them before they graduate, chances are we're not going to get them. So it's important for businesses to partner with our institutions of higher education here in the area and make sure that those programs are helping those businesses and those businesses are helping those areas of higher education. It's got to be a collaboration.
How else can higher education play a role in this? I mean, you know, you can look at programs at Western Technical College, and it's easy to see, you know, we hear about the diesel drivers or, you know, the different welding programs and how local businesses work with those. But, you know, schools like Viterbo University, UW-La Crosse, Winona State, what else can they do?
Viterbo is doing an excellent job in terms of the servant leadership concept we talked about. At Quick Trip, if we see somebody go through that program, we'll most certainly like to nab them as an employee because they get it. And Viterbo is one of the very few schools in the country that's promoting servant leadership. Those are exactly the values we're looking for, and they have an excellent program training people at the master's level in that area.
Lisa?
I think it's really important for it to be understood that it's a two-way conversation between business and higher education, as well as the public sector and higher ed, because institutions need to also promote their capabilities and a desire to have relationships with the private sector. And so those institutions, which we are very fortunate to have here, do a great job of business outreach and listening to organizations as far as what their needs are and figuring out how to become a solutions provider. So it's not just giving access to students or emailing out opportunities to students. It's actually sitting down with companies and saying, how can we work together to ensure that you have the workforce you need to grow and thrive in our community because you're important to our community?
So there's a seminar coming up on February 18th where lots of local businesses are getting together to really talk about these issues. Lisa, do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Yes, we're really excited to have our first event for 2015 focus on recruiting and retaining high-skilled talent. We have started this idea and working on it last August when I first met with John, and he gave me the inspiration for the event. And so we're fortunate to have Mayo Clinic and Mayo Health System as a sponsor of the event, and they're going to talk about their recruitment strategies and what they do, as well as we have an opening presenter, Kelly Broyley from Starbucks and formerly from Microsoft, who's going to really talk about how she transformed her management style working with the younger workers. And all of the employees she supervises right now are the younger workforce, and it's a totally different approach than she's used before. We also have other presenters from industry talking about what they're doing. And we're most excited because Susan Whitewater from People First is going to share the results of a survey of 400 millennials about what motivates them. Mm. And so we think that will be really interesting for the participants.
John, how important is it to have this conversation on a community level? Because I'm sure, you know, maybe different business leaders get together and you might talk about it, or, you know, you're talking about it around the water cooler, whatever it may be. But to really hone in on this.
First of all, it's an issue that just can't be addressed by a single business or a single institution of education. It's got to be all of us. Secondly, if every one of our work environments can be great places to work, that's good news for all of us. Because I may have a spouse that's working at UWL, and if she has a great work environment, that certainly impacts the quality of my life at home. So it's not just one business, but it's all the businesses, all the organizations, I think, have to work together to make sure that this is not just one good business, but tons of businesses and institutions where these are great places to work. It's a collaborative effort. It has to be.
John McHugh is Manager of Corporate Communications for Quick Trip, and Lisa Hare is Executive Director of Seven Rivers Alliance. They were talking about recruitment and retention of high-skilled workers to the La Crosse area. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up, cities in Trempealeau County have been working to annex frac sand mining operations. Some people argue that frac sand mines aren't the typical type of annexation for a city. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to the Seven Rivers Alliance. Our site also has archives of other recent editions, and if you'd like to share a comment or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Last fall, the Trempealeau County towns of Burnside and Lincoln voted to sue the City of Independence over the issue of whether an annexation by the city of town land is legal. The owners of a frac sand mine want to move into the city limits, which are a mile away, to allow for an expansion. There have been about a half a dozen similar instances where cities in Trempealeau County have annexed frac sand mines. Frac sand mines are considered non-metallic mines and are traditionally located in townships in rural areas. The annexations have been seen as an attempt to get around a moratorium the Trempealeau County Board placed on frac sand mines. This was a recent topic on WPR's The West Side, based in Eau Claire. Host Rich Kramer talked with Philip Freeberg, a land use regulation specialist from UW Extension's Local Government Center, Michael Coles is executive director of Wisconsin Towns Association, and former Trempealeau County Board member Tom Bice. Philip Freeberg describes the flurry of annexations in Trempealeau County as highly unusual.
This was put into place to provide for an orderly growth process of cities and villages. And with the frac sand mines, it calls to mind my background is that I am an attorney, and so prior to coming to Extension, I represented a lot of municipalities and also some citizens fighting municipalities. And we had used to have a lot of objections and litigations over granite pits, you know, much smaller types of operations. Mm-hmm. And people would be upset, and quite granite pit owners would argue, well, yeah, it's out in a farming area, but where would you expect a granite pit to be? You wouldn't expect it to be in the city. Well, now let's flip it to the phenomenon we're seeing now, where do you really expect to see a large non-metallic mining operation in the city? I mean, that's just kind of an evaluative common sense approach, but it also has a foundation in the law. Annexations, one of the means of challenging them or an issue is the courts have recognized what's called a rule of reason, and it was created by the courts to basically be a check on arbitrary exercise of annexation power by cities and villages. And among the things that are in there is kind of what we're talking about, what we're seeing here, the odd and kind of gerrymandering shapes of some annexations. That's one aspect of it. But the other one is there a reasonable or foreseeable use that the municipality would have for the particular territory that's going to be used? And does the territory have a foreseeable need to be in the city? And someone who understands the mining process can correct me on this, but I guess the challenge I see is I don't see why the residents of city would need a mine within their city limits for, except, you know, but on the other hand, what were the needs of the owners? Do they need fire protection services? Do they need, typically, water and sewer is a really common trigger for annexation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the sewer use of a frac sand mine would be very limited, and usually they rely on wells for their own process. As a matter of fact, I would guess if they are using water, if they're doing washing at the operation, the demand on a city's water system is probably far exceeds what it has the capacity to do. And I would not be surprised to learn that any of these mines that are currently in cities don't have any present need for those kind of services. Then the other kinds of services, police services, planning services, other types of city support, parks, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to imagine. Also, you know, there's certain development options that cities and villages have, such as tax increment financing as a way to kind of help the process, try to bring in jobs and development. Well, if the development's already up and running, there's not a need for that. Now, that can be brought up, but unfortunately, or fortunately, and when it's the unanimous annexation, those particular issues, the reasonable and foreseeable need of the territory residents and owners or the city for the particular parcel, is not one of the issues that can be challenged or litigated in a unanimous annexation. Hmm. However, if it is one where the majority of, if it's that kind of annexation or a referendum one, then that is a legitimate issue for a court to address. There's one other aspect, which is the contiguous aspect, that can be addressed in the lawsuits in a unanimous annexation. That one is still left open to towns.
Mike Colas, so in Tremblay County, with what Philip Freeberg just mentioned, what's your best guess at why these companies are going this route? And we'll get some more information in just a bit from Tom Bice on that front.
As Philip pointed out, these are, he didn't say it exactly this way, but these are rural land uses that are in rural areas, and there's no reasonable need for the city or village to have these. My sense is that there are a couple of real pros for a city to have this. You're getting property value, which adds to your tax base. It's considered new construction, so it increases your levy limit. So from a revenue standpoint, as a city or village, why not grab onto these things? Because it comes with a lot of benefits. And better yet, if it's geographically removed from your city or village, you don't have any of the potential negative externalities that you need to manage for. So from a city side, there's a lot of pluses and not a lot of negatives, especially if there's any kind of payment that the sand mine company provides to the city or village for the benefit of being in the city or village. And from a sand mine standpoint, if you have onerous regulations in their perspective that the town or the county, the other two local governments that would have jurisdiction when they're in a town situation, if you see the regulation as onerous, well, this is an easy way to avoid that regulation and go into a city or village who may or may not be equipped to handle the type of regulation necessary to prevent negative or manage negative externalities. And may not want to do that. So there are a lot of benefits for the sand mining companies and the cities and villages. And unfortunately, the residents, the county residents, the town residents, get to manage, or in fact, not even have the ability to manage the negative externalities. One of our big challenges, and to the question you asked, Philip, is this a new phenomenon? It's a new phenomenon, and it's a frightening phenomenon because you really have, in addition to the rule of reason being violated, as Philip went through, I think it goes beyond that. I think this is really anti-democratic, anti-representative democracy, and quite frankly, and it sounds a little out there, but anti-American. I mean, we have residents in towns and counties who are now removed from the political process. They have no ability to elect the city aldermen or the village trustees, and yet they are the people, the village trustees and city aldermen, who are making recommendations and decisions in these people's backyard. And that is something that we're very frightened about and sets a very poor precedent in the state of Wisconsin where we essentially have disenfranchisement due to annexation.
Philip Freeberg, what about, a city's growth? Because in a lot of situations, in Tremblay County at least, it seems like there's a real hot spot for these sand mines. It's near a rail line. It's in between, generally between Independence and Whitehall and in that Blair area. That's where we're seeing the majority of these annexations happening in that county. Could a city technically, by accident, I guess, annex themselves into a corner?
Well, that's kind of what I'm suggesting. If they've got a full-blown operation here and they're used to controlling land use, and zoning is basically putting into law, good neighbor policy. I'm going to operate in a way that we can all get along with my adjoining property owners very well and operate accordingly. And it's not typical for cities and villages to have ordinances that deal with non-metallic mining operations. But the other thing is the scale that happens in the sand mines is phenomenal. It's industrial use, but it's industrial on a major size. You know, it's not unusual for cities and villages to have industrial uses in them, but you're usually talking about factory type of operations.
Mm-hmm.
These are extremely large areas. And I think maybe what you're suggesting there, Rich, may be one argument for the city with a reasonable need or the type of services is perhaps they could provide some facilitation opportunities for development of rail or other type of transportation infrastructure. But then again, I'm not so sure that those same types of programs are not also available to towns. I might have to defer to Mike on that. But
Mike Willis?
Towns are better equipped to address non-metallic mining. Counties and towns are better equipped to address non-metallic mining than our cities and villages, just because historically non-metallic mining has occurred in towns and counties in rural areas. This is a rural land use, and they have addressed non-metallic mining through either zoning or licensing permits that allow for that particular piece of property to be rehabilitated.
Mike Colas is joining us from Shawano. He is the executive director for the Wisconsin Towns Association. Philip Freeberg joins us from Madison. He is the local government law educator for UW Extension. And now I bring on Tom Bice. Tom is a former Trempealeau County board member, and he was the chair for the Environment and Land Use Committee there in Trempealeau County. Tom Bice, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We've got a handful of annexations that have happened in the last 4 years. Why do you think that's happening in Trempealeau County?
It's very clear that the mining companies are interested in, if they're going to come into Trempealeau County and invest close to $100 million, they need to be able to do that efficiently. And so with the regulation getting stiffer and stiffer and stiffer in Trempealeau County, they feel that they can basically invest their money and do better if they can annex and be regulated by the local communities rather than the county.
Being on the county board, did you see this coming?
100%. As you mentioned, I was chair of the committee during our last public hearing for our current ordinance. One of my committee members, who had been on the zoning committee in Trempealeau County for many years, asked our corporation counsel if he could stand up and explain that the excessive regulation was going to cause annexations, and he wanted to explain how and why that would happen. And he was told he couldn't do that. He came to me with a resignation on paper. He resigned. He signed up to speak, and he did clarify that very clearly, that these annexations would be more commonplace if we continue to make the zoning more restrictive.
And, Tom, I'll stick with you real quick. What kind of regulations are the onerous ones that these companies are seeking to renegotiate with cities?
The only main ones that they really needed to do was hours of operation. Basically, that comes down to, if you're going to spend $100 million but only operate 80% of the time, then you may have to spend $120 million just to cover more equipment, more manufacturing, in order to meet the goals that you have as far as producing a product. So that's a lot of money for very little gain. And then the other one was the noise levels. Basically, I've been to these mining operations. They produce very little noise, but that was a huge concern. A lot of people didn't understand the concept of how much noise in the ordinance. It tended to be kind of critical as far as it made people real nervous. They didn't know what levels of noise they were going to be hearing. And so they had a overly restrictive noise ordinance, and that was the other one.
Now, I had attended a few board meetings while you were still with the Trempealeau County Board of Commissioners. Now, there was a lot of members that were very vocal, members of the public, that were very concerned about this. Did they represent the majority of people, or were they just a loud minority?
They were a loud minority. This is a real interesting concept. The sand industry Once a mining company gets the ability, a permit, or else a operating facility, they basically, at that point, turn on all their competitors. So there is no consortium of any kind in this industry. The idea is that when they can produce sand and sell sand, they do not want any more competitors. So for the most part, this mining industry does not get along with anybody. The outspoken minority continue to tell the dangers of this industry, but I can tell you I've researched every single detail they ever came up with, and there's literally no danger. Once you take the trucks off the road, there is no danger. But they were very outspoken. And again, I brought up a point about the consortium of pro-sand, pro-industry people. There is none out there because once they get their permit, once they're operating, they do not like their competitors, and there's no agreement amongst them.
These annexations, they can get kind of complicated. We've got a couple of months ago, maybe more than that, two towns in Trempealeau County started the process of challenging an annexation of a sand mine. It was the City of Independence that was annexing property owned by, at the time, Cameron Rail. It looks like Superior Silica Sands, a large Texas-based company, wanted to purchase that and develop it and make it a multiple hundred-acre mine. But the towns kind of objected to that. This is a mine that is more than a mile away from the City of Independence, so there was a strip of land annexed through through two towns to get to the property. So that's in court. Philip Freeberg, if you could guide us through what happened there. They petitioned the DOA, as you were talking about earlier. There's this procedure. The Department of Administration offered opinion on it. And could you walk us through that?
You know, the limited areas for them to review is whether the territory is contiguous to the annexing municipality.
Meaning if it's just right next door, right?
Well, no. Actually, the statute uses the term contiguous.
Okay.
And the courts, looking at that term, said, well, it's not defined in the statute, so, and it's not entirely clear. So we're called upon to interpret it, and so their interpretation is that there be some physical contact, you know, what you just mentioned, Rich.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is that the way the boundaries are then that are contiguous, that, you know, that they're not arbitrary, or they're, you know, properties that are excluded or irregular are just not there for a good public policy reason. And one of them that courts have identified is having parcels that are just there for the purpose of touching contiguous property. In other words, the parcels are coming in for no other reason other than to make them touch the particular municipality and satisfy the contiguous. So what the department did when it was reviewing it said that even though this was three separate annexations, they said it's really part of a whole. And the two parcels that were necessary to connect the mine, which went through two different towns, was the part that made them determine it wasn't contiguous. There was no reason for those to be brought into the city, at least that, and that's what the opinion of the department was. In other words, they say it's not contiguous because it has no relationship to the city in any way, shape, and form, except as a mean of access to the territory of the mine operation that was trying to come into the city.
Mike Colas, where are they at right now with this situation?
Well, they've brought suit against the city. They determined to do that within the clock.
This is towns of Lincoln and Burnside.
Right. And it is now in circuit court.
Is this a good case study for this whole new phenomenon that we're talking about?
Well, I think it is. The court previously has applied the rule of reason and the three prongs of that and essentially determined in a couple of cases, the seminal one being a Mount Pleasant versus City of Racine case, that the shape of the annexation needs to be unexceptional. You can't create crazy quilt gerrymandered boundaries, and you have that in this case. In that Mount Pleasant case, it was a balloon on a string situation, much like here. It wasn't nearly as long. The DOA has essentially cited all of these things in their response to the request from the towns to take a look at this, and it's very clear based upon previous law, that this is not a legal annexation. Yet you have these kinds of balloons on a string that are going on because the towns are frugal, they don't have a lot of money, and have to enter into that risk of losing that court case in circuit court. And anything can happen, even though the Supreme Court has been pretty clear on the lack of legality of these, so they don't often do it. The cities and villages have an opportunity to take advantage of the situation. In this case, they did. I would expect that the circuit court, if they read through the Supreme Court, would side with the two towns in this case.
The guests on today's show, we're talking about the issue of frac sand mines being annexed from townships to cities in Trempealeau County. The issue was a topic explored by WPR's Eau Claire reporter, Rich Kramer, on The West Side. A link to the full discussion is available at WPR.org/newsmakers. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at WPR.org/newsmakers. There, you'll also find a link to a story WPR has done on the annexation lawsuits. Visit our website if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, and there you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.